Welcome back to the program. George Bernard Shaw once said that life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. For many people, this is undoubtedly true. Bill Clinton might be the penultimate example of that. But for Barack Obama, it has always been about both. About understanding the world that created him, and then using the raw material to kind of reassemble the pieces to create himself anew. This journey is at the core of David Marinus' sweeping historical biography of Barack Obama. In this, his 10th book, Marinus, whose important first rule of reporting is go there, literally takes himself and us from 1920 Kansas to Kenya to Indonesia to Chicago and ultimately into the Oval Office as he deconstructs the making of Barack Obama. David Marinus is an associate editor at the Washington Post, is the author of critically acclaimed biographies of Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and Roberto Clemente. He's also written about the 1960 Rome Olympics and Vietnam in the 1960s, as well as written about the important process of being a reporter. He won in 1993 and 2007 Pulitzer Prize and has been a Pulitzer finalist three other times. It is my pleasure, as always, to welcome David Marinus back to this program to talk about Barack Obama, the story. David Marinus, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, I'm delighted to be with you again.
Pleasure to have you back. You mentioned that you had Obama's books, his memoirs, as kind of a jumping-off point, but that really didn't tell the full story. There were many things that were condensed, many things that were left out that really reflected Obama's vision of how he wanted to see himself. Talk a little bit about some of the differences between the mythology as Obama created it and some of the facts that you uncovered during the monumental research that went into this book.
First, I should say that I consider that there's a vast difference in genre between memoir and serious historical biography. I actually got a copy of Barack Obama's first book proposal, and the title was Journeys in Black and White. And I think that really tells you a lot about what he was trying to do in his book, which was look at his life and life in general through the lens of race and nothing more than that. So, as I was pursuing what I consider to be the real historical biography, there were occasions when what he wrote and what I found differed. Some of it was just family mythology passed along, which you would find in any family. I think if someone were to do a biography of me or of you or anyone else, they would uncover things about their grandparents and great-grandparents that we didn't know. That's just the way it goes. So, for instance, in his memoir, he passes along the family story that his Kenyan grandfather was tortured and imprisoned by the British, which I have to say there's a shred of possibility that that's true, but the six people that I interviewed who knew the grandfather said it did not happen. Similarly, his step-grandfather in Indonesia, when his mother remarried an Indonesian Lolo Sitoro, Lolo's father, according to the book, was said to have died as a martyr fighting the Dutch in the revolution, and in fact, I discovered that he died falling off a stool changing the drapes in his living room. So that kind of mythology can be passed along. And then beyond that, Barack Obama in his memoir uses many composite characters and compresses the chronology some. So, for instance, in his memoir he writes about a girlfriend in New York that he says he loved, and his descriptions of her did not fit in important ways, the woman that I found, who was the New York girlfriend, Genevieve Cook, who was an Australian. Some of the characteristics did fit, but Obama portrayed her as being somewhat naive racially and not understanding why African Americans could be angry, and that was not Genevieve at all. But again, he was trying to make a point about race, and he was, from what I could tell, combining a couple of girlfriends to do that.
One of the things that seems so remarkable is that as you look at the totality of the story, as you've uncovered it and you research it and you tell it, that it is less about the lens of race and more about this global story, the unlikeliness of this story, the international aspect and randomness of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to diminish the role of race in anyone's life, and particularly a biracial kid like Barack Obama's, but there is so much else involved that is that is universal and not confined by just race. The notion of leaving and being left is a very strong part of what this book is about, and that involves a father who left, who was never there, really, so Barack did not know him. A mother who was only 17 when she got pregnant and 18 when her son, Barry, as they called him, was born, and was sort of learning and growing as he was and had her own life that she wanted to fulfill. And so she wasn't there for much of his adolescence and teenage years. She was in Indonesia while he was back in Honolulu living with his grandparents. And there's so many other aspects of his creation that are just, I mean, all of us are products of randomness to one extent or another, but the way that his parents met in Honolulu in a Russian class in 1960, with the father coming from Kenya because of a series of both social movements and coincidences, and the mother getting there because of sort of the classic American wanderlust of her father going further west from Kansas to Oklahoma to Texas to California to Washington State and finally to Hawaii. All of that leading to the creation of this unlikely president.
There is so much movement in the story, so much of a sense of Obama having to learn how to adapt at every turn, this kind of rootlessness and looking for a sense of place, which ultimately he really only seems to find once he gets to Chicago later in his life.
Yeah, Jeff, I describe his life as an arc toward home. Hawaii, in some sense, was home. It's where he grew up. But, again, he wasn't completely comfortable there. He was living with his grandparents. He was in a place where the color of his skin stood out some, even though Hawaii is a very diverse place with many, many shades. There are very few African Americans there, so he had to sort of learn that aspect of his own culture. And it is a constant movement. One of the moments that struck me the most personally as I was following his footsteps was when I went to Indonesia, where he lived as a 6, 7, and 8-year-old with his mother and his stepfather, Lolo Sutoro. And he wasn't just another American diplomat's son, in the protective cocoon of westernization in an international school. He was completely immersed in that place from the time he got there. He had to learn the local language, Bahasa Indonesia. He went to the local schools. He played with the local neighborhood kids. And when I was walking the neighborhood, the narrow alleyways, and hearing the sounds of the street vendors and the smells and of that place, that an obvious thought just sort of overwhelmed me and took on a new meaning, which was what a remarkable journey it was from being 6-year-old Barry Sutoro in Mentang Dalam neighborhood in South Jakarta to President Obama in the White House.
To what extent do you think that his sense of coolness, his sense of detachment, comes from this sense of rootlessness, of never really being in places long enough to get that attached, and knowing that he was always moving on?
Well, I think he has the sensibility of a writer or of an anthropologist, which is to be an observer as well as a participant in his own life. And I think that comes much from his background, from the movement of his life, and also from being biracial and from an early age not feeling quite at home in any particular culture. So all of that. Also, there are environmental factors. Hawaii is a place where there's a saying, cool head, main thing. You know, he grew up with peers where just being cool man was kind of the thing, and Indonesia, where he spent three and a half of his formative years, is a very reserved culture. So there were cultural factors, there were factors particular to his own experience of moving, there were factors that had to do with his biracial background, all of that leading to this person who had some measure of reserve and coolness to him.
Talk a little bit about his father, Barack Obama Sr., who, as you point out, he only really met once.
When he was 10 years old, for a few weeks, yes. In the memoir, Barak states that the family was together for a couple of years, and then the father had to leave to go to graduate school at Harvard and could not afford to bring the rest of them along, which is family mythology told by the mother as a protective mechanism, I would suspect. Barack Obama Sr. was a brilliant, troubled man, and I reached the conclusion that the president was lucky he never lived with his father, even though that's the title of his book, and so much of that book is centered around a search for his father. Symbolically, in real life, he was lucky he never lived with him, because Obama Sr. was not only an alcoholic, but also physically abusive. He wasn't with Barack Obama's mother probably long enough for me to establish that he abused her, but the next wife, who was also an American...
That was Ruth Baker.
Ruth Baker and Asanjo. I spent a long afternoon with her in Nairobi, where she still lives, and she told me some horrific stories about his physical abuse.
Talk a little bit about the mother, because if there is any central character in Barack Obama's life, it is truly his mother.
Yes, Stanley Ann Dunham, the daughter of Madeline Dunham and Stanley Dunham. One would think that her name came from the father, who was sort of wanting a boy and imposed that name Stanley on his daughter instead. You know, what I learned is that the name was inspired as much by a character played by Bette Davis in a movie, when she played a female character named Stanley right before the daughter was born. And the mother, Madeline, loved Bette Davis and wanted to be like her. In any case, Stanley Dunham, later Ann Dunham, was a very intelligent, sardonic woman who didn't want to be confined by small places and had a very strong conscience and really devoted her life after she had her son and daughter to not just being an anthropologist, but really sort of trying to help women in particular make their way in Indonesia and other third world countries. And really had a, was, I would say, the conscience of the president, that, you know, she even when she wasn't there, she was trying to teach him to think as though he were in other people's shoes and to be empathetic, and the better part of his nature comes from her.
And you talk about the fact that even when he went back to Honolulu to live with his grandparents for most of his middle school and high school experience, that he and his mother spoke almost every day.
Well, she wrote a lot of letters. They talked quite often. That's not, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, there were times when he felt somewhat angry toward her because she was not there. But he always knew that her instincts were good, and that she was the one who one time said, you know, you can't just be a good time Charlie, Barry. You've got to do something with your life. You're special. And when they were in Indonesia together, she'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning just and get him up so that she could homeschool him before he went to the local schools. She was very devoted to his abilities and was you know, sort of the first believer in his, that he was something special.
And how did he respond to that when his mother would tell him that or imply that he was something special?
Well, he responded like a typical teenager at first. You know, sort of thinking, you know, why is she bothering me with this? And he, you know, in high school, his two loves were basketball and hanging out with his buddies in what they called the Chum Gang, you know, which was sort of a Native Hawaiian term for smoking marijuana. And you know, he was a good student, but didn't apply himself too hard. And it wasn't until he got to college, really, that his mother's voice started playing more heavily in his ears.
You mentioned basketball a moment ago. Basketball played a large role for him in that, among other things, it kind of connected him to the black community.
Yeah, I think, you know, think about growing up in Hawaii with black skin. Very few African-Americans there except those in the military bases. And living with his white grandparents for most of his school years. How could he find his cultural identity? Well, the first entree into the black world was basketball. His first heroes were Julius Erving, Dr. J, and Tiny Archibald and the University of Hawaii basketball team, which in the early 70s was called the first Fab Five, and many of their stars were African Americans from the mainland. And he loved basketball and played it every day of his childhood and teenage years, and was on the high school basketball team, and it really was a way for him to start to find his identity in the city game.
Talk a little bit about your journey to Kenya and what you found there, and the way in which it was informative as to understanding more about what shaped Barack Obama.
Well, it was an unforgettable trip, and even though he never lived there, although he ventured there several times as an adult, and including one trip that he writes about in his memoir. But I was really trying to figure out sort of the forces that shaped the family, and there are several common threads that come through. One is, you know, there are sort of Obama doubters in America who try to portray him as being not American and a stranger or alien, or you know the birther movement claiming he wasn't born here. Well, Obama's faced that even in Kenya. His grandfather, Hussein Onyango, was derided by a local chief out in Kanyadiang in western Kenya as a Jadak, which means an alien or a stranger, because the family had only been there for four generations, and that wasn't long enough for this chief. So there's that thread that runs through the family. The notion that President Obama is somehow, you know, the product of Muslims and a secret Muslim himself, I can refute through both Kenya and Indonesia. It's true that his grandfather, Hussein Onyango, converted to Islam. He wasn't devout. The father, Barack Obama Sr., was an atheist. And both of them, the rise of the Obamas in Kenya was made possible not by Muslims, but by evangelical Christians. It was missionaries who went out to western Kenya at the turn of the century and taught the first wave of Luo tribesmen English, boys, and one of those was Hussein Onyango, the grandfather. The father, Barack Obama Sr., was also educated by missionaries, and his mentor in Nairobi when he was a young adult was an American woman named Betty Moody, who was a missionary who came to Kenya to preach the gospel and teach literacy. And she's the one who sponsored him to come to the United States. She hired him to translate several of her literacy books into Luo, his tribal language. And she's the one who found an article in the Saturday Evening Post about the University of Hawaii that got him first interested in that place. So when you look at sort of the reality of history versus the mythology, it was conservative evangelical Christians who made the Obamas possible.
It's so interesting, you know, you mentioned the birther movement and the absurdity of that as you make crystal clear in Barack Obama the story. And you wonder why that story has legs, what it is about it. And you come to the conclusion maybe that it's not so much about race, which is what a lot of people say, but it is about this sense of somebody that is international and global and different than what we're used to.
There are so many mythologies surrounding Barack Obama. The birther movement is one of them. The secret Muslim is another. And there are others. And I think race is a factor, but also sort of a xenophobia and a fear sort of of the changing demographics in the United States. When you really think about it, his story, the immigration story of his family is sort of classically American in so many ways, and yet there is a lot of fear that surrounds him. And I would also say that for various reasons, Barack Obama became as much of a symbolic figure as a real one, so that both those who loved him in 2008 sort of infused their own dreams and hopes into this symbol of Barack Obama. And people who detest him, who are the doubters and haters, also look at a symbolic Obama as opposed to the real one and create these various conspiracy theories about him that don't hold up. But for other reasons, they want to believe these things.
Talk a little bit about the point at which, and it really goes to the second part of the book, that Obama begins to pull together all of these various threads of his life and begins to piece together an identity for himself.
Well, I think it starts at Occidental when he gets off the island to the mainland for the first 2 years of college. You see the first inklings of a sort of a sense of his search and a sense of destiny. Then there are 4 years in New York, which are really fascinating because he's so internalized everything during that period. I did find several of his girlfriends who were white, one of whom had his letters and another who kept a journal, and several of his closest friends who happened to be Pakistani, who he had met at Occidental and their friends in New York. And in all of those cases, you could see this internal sort of struggle to find himself. In one of the letters that he wrote to his girlfriend, his first girlfriend, Alex McNear, he talks about how all of his friends from Punahou and Honolulu and Occidental and Los Angeles and in New York were finding their comfortable niches in life, and he realized that none of those could satisfy him, and that for him to feel fully himself, he had to try to embrace it all. And I saw that as sort of an early iteration of his 2004 speech by which we all came to know him at the Democratic National Convention, this sense of him wanting to present himself as sort of a symbol of universality and kind of the commonality of humankind, for better or worse, in terms of how successful he's been at that in the modern American political culture. But and you also see, you know, there were several months when he was in New York when he was carrying around a frayed copy of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and he was pretty invisible himself. He, you know, there weren't that many people at Columbia that knew him. He was not part of the black student organization there, really. And even though he came to New York ostensibly to be closer to Harlem and to the grist of American, African-American culture, he really endured it alone. And it wasn't until he got to Chicago, finally, where he found his home both personally and professionally.
Why do you think it was in New York that he had so few friends, that he did not connect either with the black community or even with others? I mean, with the exception of perhaps Genevieve Cook.
Some of it was timing. He got to Columbia at a time when New York was a pretty tough place, 1981. And Columbia did not provide housing for its transfer students, so he had to sort of make it on his own. So there was some isolation there from the rest of the student body. Some of it was intentional on his part, that he really didn't want to emerge until he'd sort of figured things out. And so he became a very, very introspective, almost isolated figure for part of that time.
And when he gets to Chicago, it's at a time in which the black community is really taking hold in a powerful way in Chicago. Harold Washington has just become mayor, and there's a lot going on in Chicago with respect to the black community.
Yes, New York was in a pretty difficult period, and Chicago was a symbol of hope and light, and Harold Washington had just been elected mayor in 1983, and Barack Obama somewhat naively first tried to get a job in the Harold Washington administration, not realizing that you don't just do that without knowing somebody in that patronage society. Chicago had long been a kind of pole star for African Americans in the country, you know, with the Great Migration and the attraction it held for so many African American elite of different sorts, from athletes to artists to writers. As it so happened, within about a six-month period before he got there in 1985, three famous African Americans arrived in Chicago. The first was Oprah Winfrey, the second was Michael Jordan, and the third was Barack Obama.
What was it about Chicago that made him feel so at home for the first time?
Well, it was partly his job. He was a community organizer on the South Side in an area, Roseland, which was 98% African American. So it was really the first time that he'd been completely immersed in that black culture. And the job brought him in contact with a lot of single mothers and and older women who sort of smothered him with their lives and their love, and he'd really never felt that before, so he started to feel comfortable in a way with all of that, even though, although the job was very frustrating for him and for them. It was just a more comforting place in other ways than any place he'd been before. And I think that really helped him sort of finally make the final turn towards his personal life as an African-American.
When he gets to Chicago, is he still trying to define himself, still trying to figure out who he is?
Yeah, that's the final piece of the puzzle,
right.
I think, is there. I mean, it was a slow process. It took, 10 years. And even this book ends with him driving up to Harvard Law School. And I think by that time he'd figured himself out, both personally, what he needed to feel comfortable. He hadn't yet met Michelle Robinson, but that was coming in the next year, and she's kind of, you can see her as being almost inevitable at that point. And he had determined, he'd studied power for 3 years in Chicago and determined that to get the kind of changes that he hoped to make in the world, he needed to get into elected politics.
I mean, he really had become politicized, and you talk about that he studied political science at Columbia and even at Occidental before that.
He had studied it for several years, but he hadn't really practiced it until he got to Chicago in a very practical way. He studying the Harold Washington administration and the frustrations of trying to organize the powerless on the South Side. All of that was, and also spending every Sunday and often more than that in the black churches of the South Side, which was really a graduate school of sorts. That's where he learned his oratory and rhetoric and also a lot about politics through the black preachers.
The other corollary with this is this sense, and you talk about how he internalized for so much and for so long, this sense of deliberativeness to the point that it made people crazy sometimes.
Well, he was, as a community organizer, he was not sort of your typical organizer. That job requires sort of direct action and confrontation, which was not his style. And so his bosses in the Developing Communities Project, Jerry Kelman and others, were often frustrated by what they said was Obama's tendency to deliberate and not act. But every once in a while he would take a bold action, and I think that also is reflected in his temperament as president.
And in the time that you spent interviewing him for this book, do you sense that in any way the events of the past several years in the White House, the campaign, the White House, has shaken any of his ideas, any of his sense of himself?
I think in one dimension, although he hasn't completely given up on it, but I think he thought that he came into office with almost a sense of exceptionalism, that he was different and that he could transcend many of the bitter divisions of the modern American political world. And obviously, he's discovered that isn't so, that it's a hard world out there. And that, I mean, I'm not saying that he was naive before, but he did have this perhaps overconfidence on what he could accomplish in terms of bringing the parties together and really affecting change. And it's been a much more of a hard road for him in that respect than I think he expected, than he thought.
And then the internal irony in that being that he himself, his own story, has created some additional polarization.
Well, it has, absolutely. And as we were talking about before, it's because some people sort of look at him as a symbol of changes in the country that they don't like or that threaten them in some way. And so the story that he thought would bring the country together has been used by his opponents to try to tear it apart.
David Marinus, the book is Barack Obama, The Story. David, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for it, Jeff, and for reading the book.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.